Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on books. Like so many things in life, Jamie Attenberg can attribute her latest success to a bar, or at least the story of the name of a bar. Right, Jamie, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Her novel is St. Maisie, the fictionalized account of Maisie Gordon Phillips, a woman who would become known as the Queen of the Bowery. All right, so tell me the bar story first.
So I have a really good friend named Johnny McCormick who builds and designs and operates bars in Brooklyn, New York. And he was going to open another bar called St. Maisie. And I said, "Why? Who's St. Maisie and why?" And he started to tell me her story, which was that she was this woman who he read about who ran a movie theater on the Bowery in the 1920s through the 1940s. And she was kind of this boozy broad and known as the Queen of the Bowery. And she used to help all the homeless men. And she was kind of the center of the neighborhood there. And she would walk the streets late at night from, you know, starting at 11 p.m. at night and just hand out money and little bars of soap and help save their lives. And he said he was going to, her name was Maisie Phillips, and he was going to open this bar called St. Maisie because she was the closest thing to a saint that he had ever heard of.
Joseph Mitchell wrote about her in The New Yorker?
That's right.
And is that pretty much all we know about her? Or?
Well, we've got, kind of. He has that's the most exhaustive piece. We had that. We had her obituary and then another article that was written about her funeral and then an article when she retired from the movie theater. And in that article, it said that she was retiring to write her memoirs, which either she wrote and they never got published or she just never wrote them. And that was where I really got the idea because I wanted to read them.
So nice little hook for you. Then you write this novel in a way. I mean, it's not as if her memoir makes an appearance from time to time.
That's right.
Mostly this is her diary entries.
Right.
With other characters being interviewed. It's an odd sort of way to describe it, I guess. Some people have called it a documentary-style novel. Others have called it a collage of voices, which I kind of like the collage idea.
I think collage is the closest. I mean, I describe it as the book that the spine of the book is a diary, and then there's an oral history wrapped around it.
Right. So if you picture a documentary that, you know, where you see other people commenting on what they've heard, and I enjoyed it very much, and I thought I loved the transition from one to the other. I did, and I want to talk to you about the peripheral characters because I loved them too. And so I'm wondering, when you put this together, we know little about this woman, and here you're writing her life story. How? Always the question is how much of it is true and how much of it isn't, right? But I mean, so you have to create something.
I mean, none of it's true. It's all made up. I mean, there's obviously a skeleton to it, right? So I knew that she operated this movie theater. I had a really great sense of who she was and what her essence was and how she spoke and a little bit what she looked like, although I didn't have an actual physical picture of her at the time. And then I knew certain historical elements, and that she had two sisters and a brother-in-law. He was a gambler.
You knew the brother-in-law was. Did you know he was mobbed up?
I knew. I mean, it said he was a professional gambler.
Okay.
In the essay, I extrapolated.
Days,
it was
right,
a lot of.
Right.
It was a lot of. I mean, the thing is, if I knew everything about her, I probably wouldn't have written the book.
Right.
Because there were so many mysteries surrounding her, it became really intriguing to me, and everything just felt like a giant writing prompt to me. Like, well why is she was Jewish, but she became fascinated with Catholicism.
Right.
Well, why?
That's true. That we know.
Yeah, so there were these touchstone things that I thought, and she was kind of this, you know, she was a very sexy broad, like in my mind, in the original essay and in my mind, she was kind of Mae Westish in the way that she spoke and very confident, but yet you could never find out really what, if she was ever married or had lovers or what. So I wanted to know what that story was, too.
And so, okay, so for the rest of the interview, I won't ask you what happened and what didn't because it's really not relevant. I mean, it's your story, it's your creation, and it's wonderful that it's done. And so we know of this woman, and I think what's interesting is so much of this book, maybe I'm going to guess 80% of the book, is about her before she starts performing her saintly ways,
right.
The things that we know about her. That had to be a conscious decision.
I was interested in her origin story. To me, she felt like a superhero. And I wanted to know how. I thought, well, I already know who she is in the 1940s. and what she does with her life. I want to know how we got to that point. So I it wasn't that I wasn't interested in it. I was. Mm-hmm. But also I felt like helping a book about just helping the homeless over and over and over again would be kind of repetitive. And I wanted to know, I mean, there were these things about her. Every article described her as wearing a floppy hat with dangling bracelets and carrying a walking stick. I mean, that was a very consistent thing across the board. And I thought, how did she get the walking stick? I want to know that. And I want to write that into the book. I want to know about the hat, the bracelets, all these little things. So it was, I already knew what the end was going to be. So the beginning was the most exciting part to
right.
me.
Right. We know where she ends. How mm-hmm. did she arrive there?
Yeah.
There must be a metaphor with the cage, right? Because in the beginning of the book, she talks about how she loves the streets. And if you don't love the smell of dirt, I'm paraphrasing, but yeah. something to that effect, you know, she feels bad for you. And then she takes this job working for her brother-in-law at the Venice Theater, where she sits in a ticket cage. And she's caged for many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She escapes that cage, but the cage must have played a role.
I mean, I'm a traveler myself. I move around a lot. I live in New York, but I spend, for example, my winters in New Orleans, and I've lived all over the country, and I consider myself peripatetic. And so for me, it was like the most nightmarish kind
right.
of thing when you take this woman who's so full of life and you put her into this cage. But I think, you know, not to make a statement about larger cultural issues, but I think that often women are, you know, if they're especially in that era, if they are too candid or too boisterous or they have an opinion, sometimes they sort of get, you know, trapped in this cage
right.
or held back a little bit. And so I wanted to see what would happen when you put that person there. And the end result was that she ended up creating an incredible life for her anyway, a life of the mind, but also a life on the streets around her.
I love what she did, and I love her story, but I love the way you created these peripheral characters to strengthen her story. Maybe that's the right way to put it. So let's start with Sister T. Tell
yeah.
me about her.
I mean, everyone loves Sister T. I love her. I love Sister T and George Flicker the most because they showed up first and they were the strongest. I honestly, when I was writing it and I realized that I didn't have any research about her, I just kept thinking, well, what if I invented somebody that knew about her? So so Sister T, for example, she isn't interviewed in the book, but she shows up. She is kind of the opposite of Maisie in that she's like this young, innocent nun, but they all share this like desire to help people. Their compassion grows and builds off of each other.
She's great. She's meek, but has a great strength of confidence.
Yes. Well, she has a mission from God.
Right.
and then, for example, George Flicker was a character that I invented. He shows up in the modern timeline in oral history, and he's 100 years old, and he knew her, and he was her neighbor, and he had a crush on her from afar.
He was a war hero.
He was a war hero also. He stayed in France and had a really good time after that for a while, too. But he is just really great because he's the person that watched her from afar. And I wanted to have people that watched her in different ways. Like I thought, oh, her sister knows her in different ways, and a lover would know her in different ways. But your neighbor knows, kind of in a way, knows the most about you.
All right, I had Flicker on my list, but someone who watched her from afarther,
yeah.
in a way, is this guy Sorensen, Pete Sorensen,
yeah.
who finds her diary and falls in love with her in a way sort of that we do in reading the diary.
Yeah.
Tell me about him.
Well, I'm one of these people too. I think that
I guess I should explain a little bit.
Yeah.
So in this collage of stories, later in the book, we meet this guy Sorensen, who's the one who found the diary. We never really know where he found the diary, but then he starts turning the pages and is sort of hooked on it the way the rest of us are.
And he shows up to tell us where the diary came from, and also what his connection with her is. And he felt familiar to me because he is the kind of person who looks down at the ground when he's walking because you never know what you're going to find. I mean, I'm always finding like a little note somebody wrote to somebody else. I mean, that's like the creative mind or the writer mind, but also just keeping having an awareness of things that are going on around you. And so I didn't hear him until two-thirds of the way of the book, through the book. I did not know where the diary came from at all. And then he just showed up and said, I found it.
Yeah, and we never really do know where it came from, do we?
Well, he found it in a box near the Navy Yard. I think it says it somewhere in there.
Then that becomes a little unreliable, too, I thought.
Yeah, he found it in a box near the Navy Yard, and he found her diary, and he took it to a bar, and he sat there, and he read it, and he felt like he could smell the smoke off the pages coming off of it, and he read it slowly, and he just fell in love with her in every page.
You know, as someone pointed it out, and I didn't think of it until it was pointed out, but in a way, your character Sorensen praising your work.
Because you,
well, because you wrote the diary, right? And here's this guy Sorensen saying this diary was so great. It turned page.
It did not. That's incredibly vain. But
I didn't mean that you would have done it. But I mean,
he was praising her. I mean, right. I just wanted everyone to sort of love her because I think that she goes through so much in the book because she's really an incredibly imperfect person. So. Even though we kind of, you know, I did want everyone to appreciate it and know what she did. She drinks a lot. She, you know, cats around a lot. She's selfish at times. You know, she has a lot of bad things happen to her and she doesn't always react in the right way. So, and she's kind of violent sometimes. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't mean it as an accusation. Yeah. I just thought it was sort of an interesting sort of thing.
Oh, no, now I'm blushing and thinking about it.
The other thing is that you say that you've learned from this. I mean, New York in the 20s and 30s, very much character here.
Yeah.
And you said you've learned from it that New York is destined to continue repeating itself.
That's true.
Explain that for me.
You know, one of the really interesting things, and it's actually kind of a minor plot point, is and I discovered it in my research, is there is a Wall Street bombing that takes place in the book that when I read about it, I'd never heard of it before. No one I know has ever heard of it before. In fact, people read the book and put it down and immediately Google it. And reading it, it happened in the 20s, was so remarkable because it felt like I lived in New York during 9/11 and it felt the same. And I thought, God, we didn't, you know, is this going to happen every 80 years?
And are they going to not remember?
And are they not going to remember 9/11 in 80 years? And seeing the way that that city builds things and destroys things and deals with its homeless community and yet still manages to come together in this really tight, beautiful way. All of that to me keeps, it felt very familiar. The research felt very familiar to me.
You mentioned Google. I sat with Google. We've become good friends. The Knickerbocker Village was something I looked up. Didn't know anything about
that. It's cool.
It is.
Yeah.
St. Maisie. So Maisie helped to save a lot of people. I wonder if she helped save you a little bit too. Because as I read the story, right, you had sold the Middlesteins.
Yeah.
Hadn't realized its success yet. And you were kind of wandering.
I was. I would say the first half of the book was about figuring out, when I was writing it, it was before the Middlesteins came out. And I was trying to learn about how to be a good person. And then the second half of the book, which I wrote after the Middlesteins came out, and my editor says that I wrote the Middlesteins when I was in a low place and I wrote St. Maisie when I was in a high place, because it is kind of about, there's a joyousness to the book too,
I think.
Like
so,
it's very
yeah.
sad, but it's joyful too. So, but I don't have a lot of role models. There's a lot of noise out there, and I wanted to write one. I wanted to create one for myself.
Well, you found one, didn't you? St. Maisie.
Yeah.
Jamie Attenberg. It was nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.